Welcome to Justice Visions, the podcast about everything that is new in the domain of transitional justice. Justice Visions is hosted at the Human Rights Center of Ghent University. For more information, visit justicevisions.org.
Welcome to this last episode of our joint Justice Visions and Impunity Watch mini-series on justice efforts for Syrians. For those listeners who are just tuning in for the first time, my name is Brigitte Hermans. I'm a Syria researcher at Justice Visions based at Ghent University. And with me is Artino, a Syrian photographer and a human rights defender.
Hello, Brigitte. How nice to be back after the summer break to wrap up our Syria series. Although wrapping up is not the right word, there are still so many subjects to explore, to be honest.
Yeah, that's right. Are there particular subjects that you have in mind?
In the previous episode, we looked into victim-survivor groups, initiatives, such as the Truth and Justice Charter, and their work on a mechanism to determine the fate of the forcibly missing and disappeared. We could spend hours highlighting victims' activism and the way how survivors and their families advance their justice needs.
Yeah, it's true. We could talk about all the activities and the way how survivors and families advance their justice needs. And I think somehow we really took justice activism by victim groups as the basis of the episodes. And it was a central issue that kept resurfacing throughout this series. And it will also come back in this very episode.
We wanted to shed a light on the concrete achievements to advance justice and accountability for Syrians, and how these could also inspire justice actors in other situations of ongoing conflict, such as Myanmar, Ukraine, or Yemen.
Yeah, this last element is key because the Syrian file has so many ramifications. It firstly uncovered the weakness of the international justice system, and then it's also underscored the resilience of informal and formal justice groups. And this is what we wanted to discuss with Mohammed Abdallah, the director of the Syrian Justice and Accountability Center, SJAC, and Catherine Marquiuel, the head of the IIIM UN body dedicated also to the investigation and prosecutions of crimes that happened in Syria.
And to really wrap up, we also called in Habib Nassar of Impunity Watch to reflect on these interviews and to make some concluding reflections. Let's start first listen to your interview with Mohammed Abdallah.
You're both an activist and the head of the Syrian Justice and Accountability Center. And of course, you've been involved in justice and accountability efforts for Syrians since the early days. How would you assess the efforts for justice for Syrians and what has been achieved so far, 11 years after the start of the revolution?
There's good efforts and momentum started early in 2011 in terms of documentation, collecting evidence, trying to work in different level of groups. Some groups covered Syria nationally, some groups covered certain cities and towns. A lot of initiatives, a lot of cooperation between groups. And this type of documentation, while a conflict is active, was basically a precedent in the modern history of conflicts. Of course, cell phones helped a lot. Everybody had a camera, everybody had a cell phone. A lot of videos made it to the internet. Although we're geared to be advocacy materials, people want to film and show what's happening and what the government forces are doing, it ended up being good evidence to be shared in courts later. In our database, we have 1.4 million videos from YouTube alone. We downloaded videos from YouTube to preserve them just before YouTube started tightening their policy and removing videos that violate their term of use. And a lot of these videos showing a lot of corroborating evidence. Different people never met together, uploaded different videos from different locations. So the efforts were put by the public were really, really high. Not only the civil society, everybody kind of took up a risk to pull their phone and film, while actually pulling your phone and take a picture or a video could put you at a serious risk in a place like Syria.
Could you elaborate here on the efforts by civil society organizations?
The efforts of the civil society were also very well organized, I would say. A lot of groups did a good job in preserving information, categorizing it, analyzing, trying to extract patterns of violence, trying to work in the advocacy front and showing what's happening in the country, but also later in the accountability when Syrian refugees arrived to Europe in big numbers and there became a potential for filing cases against Syrian government officials and other human rights perpetrators, the Syrian army, ISIS, opposition fighters. So I think the efforts are really good, but unfortunately the outcome is quite modest.
And why do you think that the outcome is so modest, or put differently, what are the complicating factors here?
That's clearly because we know Syria is not a state party to the International Criminal Court, and there is no international tribunal for Syria. Russia is an active player in Syria. They have incentives to cover what's happening. So expecting an international tribunal for Syria is kind of a dream now with the Russian involvement. And the best thing the UN could come up with was the International Independent Impartial Mechanism, the IIIM. Meanwhile, lots of commanded efforts by authorities like Germany, Netherlands, France, Sweden. But that's very, very, very narrow. Like, the prospect of these trials is going to be very narrow. The impact of them in Syria to make changes in the policies in Syria in terms of disappearances or torture or stopping level of violence is going to be minimal, if any. In fact, it could be sometimes backfiring because the government in Syria want to show in quotes sovereignty, so they don't care if one of their officials or former officials in trial. Arrest will continue, torture will continue, disappearance will continue. So this is one of the things stuck in my head for years, that how much justice efforts is making impact on the day-to-day life of Syrians in terms of deterring violations, scaring officials, changing policies and violation or state practices in Syria. And honestly, the honest answer is zero. It's not changing anything.
Clearly, there's very limited space for justice work inside Syria. And of course, there's no prospect for regime change anytime soon. In such a context, can justice for Syrians be truly achieved outside of the country? And how do you see the future of justice and accountability for Syrians?
ICC remains the best option for international crime. But then you're talking about a country with massive human rights violations, a lot of people involved. That opens up the question for domestic justice processes, how the domestic justice processes would look like, who will be involved. And that's why you need more than criminal accountability to fix Syria or put Syria back together. You cannot put 100,000 person on a trial, for example. You cannot imprison a huge number of people. They're going to be security issue, resource issue. Their families will turn to be enemies of the state, big contributor to instability in the future. This is, of course, if there's any transition in Syria to start with. That's why a comprehensive transitional justice programming should be looked into, truth-telling mechanisms, vetting elisteration, getting some people out of the system based on evidence, but also having the families and the victims contribute to the truth-telling processes is equally important. Not everybody will be satisfied from any process in the future, given the magnitude of the violations and different group of victims in Syria. And the worst thing is to create hierarchy of victimization or victimhood, where there is the 5 stars victims who have access to international lawyers and languages, and there's the ones below them and below them, till the average person who just happened to be in the wrong place in the wrong time and get arrested died under torture, where their families doesn't have access to any of these resources. So it's going to be very complicated. And without a domestic processes in Syria, I do not believe Syria will be put back together. And domestic processes will not be credible if somebody like Bashar al-Assad started such domestic justice processes. Whether it's a truth-telling, a missing persons programming, where there's a discussion now on a missing persons mechanism, even if the Syrian government cooperated and opened their prisons, there would be lots of doubts and questions on credibility and authenticity of the process, let alone the fear actor, where a lot of people will not participate in such process if the existing Syrian government is leading it, because clearly they're scared, and rightly so. They witnessed all this horror, the machinery of disappearing and torture. If that's not changed in a way that's irreversible, I do not think anybody will take such justice processes seriously.
Based on your work and your experience, what lessons would you draw from the justice efforts in Syria that are relevant to national and international actors in other ongoing conflicts, such as Ethiopia, Myanmar, Ukraine, and of course, Yemen?
Two things here. One, documentation, clearly, it's a key thing. Lebanon had an amnesty, and one of the arguments of the amnesty after the civil war was like, we don't have evidence, nobody documented anything. Iraq had a tribunal, but it had a bad justice because also it lacked documentation. A good, credible, authentic documentation could help base the justice processes in the future to start on the right footing, to be fair, to be comprehensive, and to be inclusive of everybody, and also to set the truth and the record correct for everyone. Of course, groups will not be happy with the truth about their own violations, but this is how it's going to be. So documentation. The second thing is to take any interim steps could be possibly available and use it to the extent possible. Syrians got into the debate whether IIIM is a sufficient thing. It's not a tribunal. It's not putting people behind bars. This is what we have today. Let's take it. Let's build cases with IIIM. They're doing amazing work. Let's put it all together. In 5 years, we don't know. Russia will change. A regime change in Russia will happen. And then nobody sheltering Syria or the Syrian government at the Security Council. We might have a tribunal. But I think giving up is not an option, given the level of violation here. And I want to encourage the mechanisms and the people in these countries also to work together, because it's going to take time. And this is the sad reality. Justice will take a long time.
It is interesting to revisit the issue of documentation that lies on at the heart of the justice efforts, and to hear from Mohammed that criminal accountability will not be enough. I want to jump in and ask our colleague Habib Nassar, what's your thoughts on this?
I agree with Mohammed that domestic justice efforts are essential, and these for at least two reasons. Firstly, if such efforts happen in the future, this would indicate regime change and a democratic transition. And because a genuine democratic transition is the ultimate form of justice, as it would remove perpetrators from power. And this was actually the goal of Syrians who revolted back in 2011. But then the second reason why I agree with Mohammed on why domestic justice efforts are essential is because such processes, if conducted by reformed or new Syrian institutions, are the only way to ensure that the justice process is fully legitimate. It is embedded in the Syrian state, it is embedded in the Syrian society, and can properly deal with the root causes of abuses.
Where would you disagree then with Mohammed?
His perception of what the ICC could have done. When he says that the ICC remains the best option for international crimes, I would like to be a little cautious. We celebrated back in July of this year the 20th anniversary of the ICC. Its track record and what it has achieved in this past 20 years, I must say, is pretty disappointing. Compared to the resources invested in it, it only issued so far a handful of convictions, and its processes are slow. Enforcement is complicated. The impact of trials held in The Hague, in the Netherlands, remain limited. So I wonder if the ICC would have been able to do better than, say, the Koblenz trials, which ended with the conviction of two senior regime officials and took place in a country actually hosting hundreds of thousands of Syrian refugees, including victims of abuses, who got, because of the proximity of the court, to easily participate in the procedure. They were directly involved in this process. I would also wonder if the combination of the IIIM and the possibility to hold trials in a number of countries based on universal jurisdiction and other forms of extraterritorial jurisdiction is not a better option, albeit a temporary one, of course, that could contribute as little steps towards accountability while preserving evidence for future, more comprehensive and potentially national domestic processes.
And I guess that you would probably also insists very strongly on the centrality of the efforts of Syrian civil society actors in achieving both what happens at Koblenz and also in rendering the work of the IIIM possible. And of course, these efforts are documentation, as Mohammed reminded us, advocacy, litigation, and also using the arts to advance justice and to fight against disinformation. All these efforts, of course, are justice in the making.
Justice in the making that brings us to the conversation with Catherine Marquis-Ouel, the head of IIIM. She also demonstrates the importance of cooperation between formal and informal actors.
To start the interview, I wanted to ask you about the creation of the IIIM. And the IIIM was created in December 2016 after the failed attempts, of course, to refer the situation in Syria to the ICC. Almost 6 years after the creation of the IIIM, how do you assess the contributions to advance justice for Syrians?
When I look back at what has been achieved by the IIIM teams, since it became operational in May of 2018, I must say that there have been real achievements. Maybe it's important to recall that the IIIM has really been conceived as a justice facilitator to assist in the investigation and prosecution of persons responsible for the most serious crimes under international law committed in Syria since March of 2011. So it's not a court or a tribunal. It's about supporting justice opportunities that currently exist, but also those which may arise in the future, and this irrespective of the affiliation of perpetrators. To date, we have been able to put in place 75 cooperation frameworks, including with states, UN entities, including the Commission of Inquiry on Syria, other international organizations, and a large number of civil society organizations. Most of these frameworks are allowing the IIIM to collect materials which have been gathered by these entities. And when I'm talking about materials, it means videos, pictures, satellite imageries, internal documentation, and of course, statements from victims and witnesses that have been given to these entities. So our first concrete achievement really is our central repository. It gathers and preserves over 2.3 million records of information and evidence that we've collected from a variety of sources. We've used the repository to provide support to competent jurisdictions in response to their request for assistance. To date, we've received 198 requests for assistance from 14 competent jurisdictions. And these requests relate to 160 discrete investigations. That gives an idea of the scale of investigations that have been ongoing and that some of them have led to trials. We've been able to support 113 of them. And as I said, some have led to trials, including the Koblenz trials in Germany.
In this realm of supporting justice initiatives, are there other activities that IIIM is conducting and that we might not be aware of?
We conduct open source searches in languages that jurisdictions sometimes lack capacity in. When this is appropriate, we can even engage in targeted collections or conduct our own investigations. We also collect statements from overview witnesses, expert evidence to help placing the crimes in their context. A Swedish prosecutor was describing us recently as a central hub she turns to find support for her investigation. And I think that's really this notion of a justice facilitator that is meant by our mandate. Directly respond to a second aspect of the mandate, which goes to analyzing the evidence that we collect, including for the purpose of case building.
That was quite an extensive overview of the first set of activities that really render you into a justice facilitator, which is a beautiful notion. Now, could you elaborate on the second part of your achievements, the structural investigations?
The work we do in that context is not only used to support ongoing investigation, it also serves building analytical blocks for our own case file, but also for future accountability. We develop analytical work focusing on identifying and understanding the entities behind core crimes committed in Syria, as well as the role that individuals play within these entities. We also try to understand the connection between different entities involving the crimes. overarching contextual factors that are relevant for prosecuting core international crimes, as well as structural factors which are necessary to understand patterns in the commission of crimes. We also, of course, try to understand patterns of targeting individuals and communities based on specific and often intersectional characteristics such as ethnicity, religion, age, gender, sexual orientation, or any other characteristic. The beauty of the concept is that we're able to detach these analytical blocks that we produce in these lines of inquiry and share it already with national jurisdiction. We have currently three ongoing lines of inquiry. One relates to detention-related crimes, with a focus on crimes attributed to government and affiliates. We have one focus on unlawful attacks, including attacks making use of chemical weapons, but also conventional attacks against medical facilities. And we have a line of inquiry which is focusing on crimes attributed to ISIL-Daesh.
As you might know, in the previous episodes, we focused very strongly on innovative efforts by Syrian civil society groups, victim organizations to advance justice and, of course, victim rights. And I wanted to ask you about your perspective on the way how the IIIM complements these efforts and also vice versa.
The most obvious way of contribution is placing the material that they've gathered and at times the analytical work that they themselves done as part of this central repository of evidence is the first and obvious way. From the outset, I determined that the IIIM would engage in a two-way communication with Syrian civil society actors and that they could mutually work towards accountability for crimes committed in Syria in many other ways than just using the documentation. They bring perspective, they have understanding of the context of the crimes, of the reality on the ground that we didn't have and probably we still don't have after 6 years of operation. So just to give you a little bit of a history, even before my appointment, there had been in Lausanne a meeting between representatives of the startup team that the Secretary General had established and several civil society actors. And this was for the purpose of presenting the mandate of the IIIM, but also listening to civil society organizations' expectations about the role the IIIM could play within this accountability framework. And when I was appointed, I immediately decided to pursue this regular engagement, wanting it to be really a two-way engagement. Fortunately, it's been supported and hosted by the Kingdom of the Netherlands and Switzerland. So we call it the Lausanne platform, but in fact, the meetings that take place in that platform are taking place in different locations between the two states. And during one of these early meetings in 2018 already, we signed a protocol of cooperation between the IIIM and the attending CSOs. Because of the level of trust reached, we also hear preoccupation, criticism, constructive criticism about things we're not doing that they would want us to do, where are the limits, but we're also sometimes able to incorporate their perspective into the work we do.
Maybe very briefly to follow up on the victim-centered approach, there's five victim and survivor organizations that launched the Truth and Justice Charter. They are also calling, of course, for the creation of an international mechanism to uphold the right to know. Could you maybe briefly touch on the way how the IIIM fits into that equation?
Well, maybe I should stress first that I really consider the Truth and Justice Charter in itself as a really powerful expression of victims and survivors' call for justice. And you're talking about the call for creation of an international mechanism to help the search for missing persons. I have very early on interpreted our mandate as encompassing support to forms of justice broader than criminal justice. And the search for missing persons is an obvious component of that. We know from past accountability process that when you collect evidence for the purpose of criminal accountability, the material you collect also encompass very useful information that can be put to use when searching for the missing. And this is the case with the archives of ad hoc tribunals, still searched as we speak by entities searching for the missing. So We do not have the capacity to do a dedicated collection for that or dedicated analytical work, but we make use of our review of the material we collect for our criminal accountability work and tag what we know will be relevant for that. And I've taken part in the consultation that followed the adoption of Resolution 76-228, which requests the Secretary General to conduct a study on how to bolster efforts to clarify the fate and whereabouts of missing persons in Syria and provide support to their family. And I really hope that it will meet the expectation of the families. We don't know whether it will lead to creating a mechanism as they wish or whether other and additional steps will be taken. But certainly the mechanism has the intent to support such an entity if it is created. It could be a game changer for the families. And we really are extremely willing to be part of that support.
Thank you. Finally, I wanted to ask you to reflect more broadly on international justice, criminal justice and beyond. Based on your experiences, especially within the IIIM, if you had any recommendations to those seeking justice in other conflicts such as Yemen, Myanmar, Ukraine and Libya?
Clearly, each situation is specific, but based on this first experience, I would say we know that investigating core crimes nowadays requires investing in technology. We're not investigating only as we did traditionally, where those traditional approach are still important, but you really need to invest in having the benefit of the tool that technology permits. One lesson would be really invest in that, have the way to use technology. The second is very much in line with what I've described. When there is an activist society in a country, engage with them, even if it's a diaspora, even if you have no access to the country. And our experience to date shows that with no access to Syria, there is a lot you can do, actually. We've learned from past accountability processes, and we know very well already in the context of Syria, that if you want to make sure that you support inclusive justice, you're going to have dedicated efforts towards surfacing the experiences of victims which are less visible. Clearly comes to mind women, boys and girls, people with disabilities, people with different sexual orientation or identities. I mean, unless you have dedicated efforts, you're not going to be able to properly represent the harms that they suffered from, and also understand how some of the structural factors in the society are triggering violence toward those groups. That's something that we at the IIIM decided to devote a victim-survivor-centered approach. And it's not just a buzzword. It's not just consulting representative. It's also dedicated strategies to surface those harms, to make sure that they are part and operationalized in every aspect of the work we do. And it's not about building one case on gender-based crimes or sexual violence. It's in every analytical work we do, looking at those aspects. If you're not looking for it, you're not going to find it. If you're not asking the right questions to victims and survivors when you interview them, you won't get the information, or you likely won't. So it's less about us as a IIIM. It's more about how can we support justice for victims and survivors.
Thank you so much for providing also these lessons, which I think are so important. And also what you said about rendering visible what is often not that visible, or rather who is not visible, the groups that are often marginalized.
Thank you, Bridget.
Habib, I can imagine that there's a lot that you can relate to in this conversation. What are the key lessons that we can draw from Catherine's testimony?
I would imagine that the key lesson that we can draw from what we just heard is probably innovation. Not many experiences such as Syria's has shown the power of innovation, the power of going beyond the templates that have been promoted, but what has become to be known as the transitional justice industry that was very active in the wake of the Arab Revolution. So Syrians have really shown how to adapt to a particularly complex situation of a country in conflict with very little space for activism and justice inside Syria, with very limited access. They have shown us how to grab opportunities in a creative way, how to delocalize justice efforts, what role refugee communities and victims and survivors can play outside of the country, what to do, for instance, when an ICC referral is blocked, how to slowly but efficiently fill the justice gap. So they kind of turn their despair in the face of international inaction or paralysis, in the face of regime brutality, into activism, into action for justice.
When we talk about activism, we often relate to the issue of resistance, innovation, and also creativity. That's an issue that you often address, and you also did so in the first episode, Habib, when we talk about justice efforts for Syrians. The creativity is really enormous and striking.
Absolutely, and I think the transition and justice is about creativity. And here I would also like to highlight the creativity of Katrine Marquiuel and her team. We are not used to creativity and innovation when it comes to international justice mechanisms, which are generally characterized by their rigidity and inability to adapt to complex situations. I think that the IIIM very quickly understood that lack of access to Syria could not be an excuse to do nothing. They saw in the lack of access an opportunity to deepen their engagement with civil society, to rely and use the wealth of data, information, evidence gathered by Syrian NGOs and activists. And they fully engaged through the Lausanne process that Katrine described, with this civil society. And the Lausanne process has become a first of its kind model of engagement with civil society and victims. Another example of the IIIM's creativity is the way it has, for instance, responded to the crisis of the missing in Syria. Instead of saying there is nothing that the IIIM's mandate would allow us to do, they interpreted their mandate and decided to adopt a specific methodology to classify relevant data they possess in order to lay the groundwork for the search of the missing by a dedicated entity.
Thank you, Habib. It's amazing, all this kind of work. And this brings us back to where we started. Despite the enormous obstacles to advance justice for Syrians, there are so many groundbreaking initiatives.
Our idea behind this series on justice efforts for Syria was to highlight innovation and justice initiatives from below. I believe that really the wonderful innovation experiences, activism stories we heard exceeded our own expectations.
Yeah, true. These conversations really underscored again the vitality of the transitional justice community in action, the practitioners, and how they also managed to reinvigorate debate that was actually quite stale. And they also changed the terms of the justice efforts while the conflict is ongoing.
This is exactly the energy that is also what we wanted to stress in this series. And here I would like to pay a tribute to all of our guests from Syria and international CSOs and institutions. In particular, today I wanted to thank Katrine Marquiuel and Mohammed Abdullah.
And Impunity Watch would like to thank the Dutch Postcode Lottery for their support, which contributed to the production of the podcast series.
And thank you to our listeners, and stay tuned for the next seasons. Feel free to share your comments and thoughts on this series of justice efforts for Syrians. Thank you, Habib and Ardino.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This was Justice Visions. To re-listen to this episode or to browse our archive, visit our website, justicevisions.org, or subscribe now via Spotify or Apple Music. Justice Visions is made possible through generous funding of the European Research Council.